Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about the book Extra Extra, Eat All About It, Recipes and Culinary Curiosities from Historic Wisconsin Newspapers. And the authors are with us today. Randy Julia Ramsden, with us by phone, I believe. Randy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, Jane Conway, the other author. Jane, thank you for joining in.
Thank you for having us as well. We're so excited to talk about our book.
Well, it's a fun book. And of course, Randy and Jane worked together on the National Digital Newspaper Program at Wisconsin Historical Society. And in 2019, I believe, Randy and Jane started writing the Cooking Up History series, which inspired this book. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. What's a really old recipe you know? Maybe a weird one. Give us your questions about the way people cooked or ate way back in your 1800s, perhaps. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I have to say, my producer today, Clara Neipert, and I both read the book and enjoyed it very much. It's just a lot of fun to just read, and some pretty good recipes in there as well. What do you hope readers gain from Extra, Extra, Eat All About It? Jane, what do you think?
I think what we envisioned with this book was kind of how we approached historical cooking. I mean, neither of us are professional chefs. We just were fascinated by these recipes we came across and wanted to try them out and have fun while doing it. So we tried to put together kind of a casual cookbook that's approachable, that shows people that cooking historical recipes can be fun, it can be low stress, and the history alongside them can be equally as entertaining. So we just tried to create a really approachable book.
You know, one thing that I really liked about it, that there were so many tidbits and interesting stories, backstories to the recipes, or just backstories to the era, the time when the recipes were produced. You know, we find out a little about commercial canning in Wisconsin, or we've got really interesting stories about cherries and during Prohibition and the evolution of sandwiches and a whole lot more. And we'll get to those as we go along. But I'm wondering, what insight do newspaper recipes give us about a moment in history? And how does that differ from cookbooks? Maybe Randy can talk about that.
Yes. I think it's that newspapers could publish much faster than a cookbook, right? That's much more curated. And so we find a lot of the little trends that people would just try out. And maybe they wouldn't stick and they wouldn't make it into a cookbook, but we do see them in the newspapers. The one, for example, is in the 19-teens, that there was a craze about cooking everything and anything in paper bags in your oven.
Yeah.
So we tried that out with a stuffed onion, and we really like it. It's one of our favorite recipes now. But it's kind of a trend, or was a trendy thing that kind of fell out of fashion after the teens.
Yeah, there were some other things that fell out of fashion, too. Breakfast parties were popular around 1900, if I'm not mistaken. People would have breakfast parties.
Yes, they were. Which fascinated us. I mean, it's hard to say exactly why, but they were so fashionable. And what I love is the connection between these breakfast parties and the social column in the newspaper, which I feel like we don't really have social columns in our newspapers anymore. But back in the day, you really wanted to be mentioned in the social column as having been attending one of these breakfast parties. And they would list all the attendees, who was hosting. Sometimes it even lists what was served. And it inspired us. I think we'd like to host a breakfast party at some point.
We call them brunches now, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get to sleep in now.
We get to sleep in a little bit. And sometimes do a lot of the make-ahead the night before or the day before. Oh, man. What questions popped up for you as you began cooking? I mean, things were, the tools and so forth were different.
Yes. The little things in the recipes, we started out just, you know, trying different recipes that we would find and thought, how hard can it be? But then we really, there were more and more questions that kind of came up. So how would they have beaten their egg whites at the time, right? What was available? Because now we just have our stand mixers or hand mixers. But before there was really electricity in most households, what would they have used? And so we started looking into that in the newspapers. And that's so great about that resource of the historic newspapers. You can find ads for the kitchen gadgets that were available and new inventions and patents and all that.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me. And then some of the terms. Like a hot oven. You had to do a little digging to figure out what's a hot oven, didn't you?
Yeah, and it's right. Ovens, especially when they were wood fired, you really had to know your equipment much better. Thermometers weren't usually used in kitchens. You just kind of had to get a feel for what you were working with. And so there was no standardization of temperatures. Like Fahrenheit wasn't used in the kitchen until much later. And so it was more like cook that in a cool oven or a slow oven. And you just kind of had to figure out what that meant. Luckily, then later we see some campaigns to help. Well, mostly women in the kitchen kind of standardize and be more efficient. And then the use of the thermometers started. And that's when we also see some conversions in the newspapers. And so that's how we could kind of figure out what we should do with our modern ovens.
Well, and I might add to this that you write in a very entertaining way. And I was amused by some of the comments that you had about testing. You tested all the recipes in the book, mm-hmm. and you had help.
Yes, yes. we tested all 50 recipes in the book. I mean, we tested a bunch more, and then we picked 50 to put into the book. And we it kind of turned out into a Sunday night dinner event with some friends, and they were all very gracious with their taste buds, and they tested it all and were pretty honest, gave us opinions.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm very grateful for their bravery because we needed a group to test these with us.
Well, it sounded like a lot of fun to me. I wish I'd have been in your group. I would have loved to come and sit in and on those testing evenings on Sunday evening. And you in the book, it's interesting. I mean, you made some changes to the recipes a little, but you included the actual clipping of each recipe alongside your reprint. Why did you do that? I liked it, by the way, but what was your thinking?
We that was a decision that we felt really strongly about because we really wanted to keep the spirit of experimenting and kind of trying these out for yourself in the book. And while we were very happy with our interpretations and the changes that we made to the recipes to make them work in our modern kitchens, we also wanted to let readers look at the original recipes themselves. And if they decide that they want to interpret it a different way, that's great. I think that's really what we wanted to happen with our book. We want people to delve in and be curious.
You have a very funny story to talk about fire-baked eggs as it relates to camping. But let's talk a little bit about the history of camping in Wisconsin. How has the meaning of the word camping changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, we have in the beginning kind of military camps, also lumber camps, right? More related to work and where you had to be at a certain time. And then the idea of camping, kind of like we know it now, the casual camping came a little later. And it actually started more of what we now would call glamping. So rich people usually who had leisure time brought beds, like bed frames, and, you know, to spend time outdoors. But it was very much like they had tubs and they had very heavy equipment. And so it's a little later that the average person would have leisure time to go out and enjoy nature that way, and that it became more simplistic. And that's what we were looking for, kind of the recipes that were simpler. We have a little bit of a story of a group of young men who go out and canoe down a river and then would camp overnight. And so what would they have brought and what would they have cooked? And that's where the fire-baked eggs came into play.
It was published in the Wausau Pilot on October 3rd of 1911, and you ran some challenges with this recipe. Tell us about the process.
Yeah, I mean, you make a fire, and then you set the eggs by the fire. And the instructions are very vague, like how far from the fire. So, like, against the stones you would, the rocks you would put around the fire, maybe. But yeah, if they're too close, we notice that they tend to explode. And when it happened the first time, we had our group of friends there, and we thought we were getting shot at. Because there were some people in the woods that were practicing their shooting, and so we thought we were getting shot at because there were just things flying out of the fire, and you could hear the explosions. Luckily, that was not the case. It was just the eggs, and nobody was harmed, but it was definitely a learning curve for us.
Oh, boy.
A big learning curve, yeah. We have friends, like, picking out egg remnants and shells from their hair and on their clothes. It was it's one of our favorite memories together. Yeah.
Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramson, our guests. They are the authors of Extra, Extra, Eat All About It, Recipes and Culinary Curiosities from Historic Wisconsin Newspapers. A really fun read with some really good-looking recipes in it as well. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you listening in today on WPR News. We're talking with our two guests, Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, authors of the book Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe your own experience to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. It's a cookbook. It's a history of recipes from historic Wisconsin newspapers, and it's very entertaining reading. So hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. To talk about nutrition for a minute, newspapers also offered nutritional advice alongside the recipes. Tell us about some of the nutritional advice. The Vilas County News had some, but maybe comment on it. Randy, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. I mean, there was just trends overall, kind of how we talked about it earlier, of what you could be cooking, but then also health-wise, right? What was recommended at the time, what wouldn't have been recommended. We can see some information from the government being reprinted in the newspapers, and then that being incorporated in the recipes we would find.
Yeah. Bananas. There are a few recipes for bananas in the book, and they're, of course, they're not native to Wisconsin. How did bananas get to the Midwest?
Yeah, we found that actually with a couple ingredients, right? Bananas, but also coconuts. We have a coconut cake from 1888 in the newspaper that we found in the newspaper. And so our thought was, well, wouldn't people just cook with what they had available in their gardens? But we learned, no, the world was much more globalized than that already. So the introduction of bananas was really interesting. There were instructions or recommendations on how to make them palatable to Wisconsin readers. So we were kind of thinking, it's a very different banana from what we know now. The heirloom bananas, there were different varieties. Whereas now we have mostly one, the Cavendish banana. And so the tastes were different, and people had to kind of learn how to consume bananas. And the newspaper was a great source to kind of find out how they would figure that out.
And banana peels caused quite the uproar. And, you know, there was a saying back when I was a kid, I think, what, did you slip on a banana peel or something? And I had never seen a banana peel thrown anywhere, but I guess that was a concern way back.
Yes, it was definitely. We only knew it from cartoons, right? Looking at cartoons and people slip on banana peels, kind of a slapstick comedy. But there were, we found some articles mentioning that people slipped on banana peels and got hurt. And so some places, and that was mostly in the coastal regions of the country, right, where the bananas would come in, and there was a lot of consumption there. People didn't know what to do with peel, so they just threw it on the ground, and people would slip. And then people would call for legislation to kind of regulate how to dispose of your banana peels. But we do also see that in Wisconsin newspapers mentioned.
And you have a banana salad recipe published back in 1916 in the Mineral Point Tribune. Looked interesting. How does it come together? Do you remember off the top of your head, Jane?
Yes, that one, you know, we looked at that recipe, and there's part of us that just loves the absurd as well. You'll come across it in historic recipes, and this banana salad recipe really encapsulated that for us. It is just bananas. You'll peel them, cut them in half, and then top them with mayonnaise and a sprinkle of chopped peanuts, and then the recipe recommends to serve them on a bed of salad leaves. And, you know, we were curious, like, maybe this'll work. The flavor profiles will create something amazing when we try it. And it wasn't bad. It was definitely palatable, but it did just taste like bananas with mayonnaise and peanuts on them. It was exactly, you know, kind of what we were expecting.
Oh, boy. Ann in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Larry. I enjoy your show so much, and especially today with the cooking. I was involved in the Hawks Inn development in Delafield, which was a stagecoach inn for a long time. And we put together a cookbook of recipes that we found on the premises where they served their guests. And I thought it was really funny that they included they called for butter the size of an egg. Well, that's very confusing, but you kind of guess at it and go for it, and I guess it didn't make too much difference. Anyway, and as far as the bananas, well, I'm from Iowa, southern Iowa, and, yeah, I grew up with banana sliced lengthwise, but my mom put any kind of nuts on it that she found after the mayonnaise and served it on lettuce. That's so funny that I hear about that. Anyway, I'd love to get the book, share it with my children and grandchildren. How do I do that? Is it a Wisconsin publication?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Jane, tell us how we get the book.
Of course, yeah. Well, you definitely check out your local bookstore to see if they have it, but then it can be easily ordered online at the Wisconsin Historical Society website, and you'll just look up our book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It, and they make it very easy to order from there.
And there you go. Thanks so much. Well, butter the size of an egg. Did you get any of, did you see that at all, Randy?
Not the like size of an egg specifically, but right, like different spoons or you know, your grandma's heirloom cup full of flour, and then you just think, okay, I don't know what that cup was, and that's when we started experimenting, right? How much of that should actually be in there, and that's part of the fun, to kind of experiment, make lots of batches of the same thing, and see what works out best.
And Anne and anybody else, I'll let you know, we have a link to the book. We will have a link to the book on our website at 2wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date. And we post the shows, each day's show at 2 o'clock. So you will have a link to the book at 2 o'clock right there. Or if you want to hear the whole show all over again, all of our shows are online, and you can find them there. So there you, Ann, thanks so much. That was great, a great call. Susie in Manitowoc, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for the show. It's really fun, and so much fun to hear her story about the exploding eggs. Oh, and it brought back memories of my sisters and cousins went camping and took some canned goods with us. We were preteens, even smaller, some of us were. And my cousin Myra said, we want to do beans. You always take beans when you're camping. So we want to do beans. So she said, oh, put this right in the fire. She said, you don't have to open it first. She said, I've seen them do this in movies. Well, we put it in the fire and went about our business, kind of forgot it. Pretty soon, we heard, boom, explosion. And like Randy said, we thought we'd been shot. But then we went down the hill, and there were beans all over the place, and the can was flat. It totally opened up the can flat, and it was on the hill. We laughed and laughed and laughed till our sides ached.
Oh, that's a great story, Susie. Oh, my goodness. Jane, have you gotten stories from folks who have read your book or looked at it? Those kind of fun stories like that?
No, honestly, this is one of the first ones we have that about exploding food, and I just absolutely love it. Yeah.
Susie, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Dee in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Dee.
Well, I love recipes from newspapers, but I like cookbook recipes too, especially church cookbooks. A recipe that had eluded me since my mother-in-law died 35 years ago was her recipe for a German dessert that she called Schmackkuchen. Some of the family members got it, but I was not one of the lucky ones, and I have been trying to make it for all these many years. I happened to be looking for a different recipe in an old cookbook that had belonged to her at Christmas time, and here I found the recipe. But like those recipes you have found, that was a little vague. It said a moderate oven. It said roll out in the sheet pan. It didn't give me sizes. I made it. I know how we will modify it to make it more like hers, but yeah, it's a lot of trial and error.
Dee, thanks. And it was a lot of trial and error for you, wasn't it, Randy?
Yeah, it's. I think we just recently made an election cake, which used to be a thing for, you know, people making cake on election day. And it called for an obscene amount of yeast. And we just couldn't fathom putting that much yeast into a simple cake. And so, yeah, we started looking into it, but people used brewer's yeast, right? Like the consistency of the yeast were much different. They weren't as active as the dry active yeast we can buy now. And so, yeah, you kind of look at the history of the ingredient as well to kind of make sense of the amount.
Yeah, if you use the same amount of active dry, you'd probably get another exploding.
Yeah, I think it was over a cup, or like a cup, something like that. And
Oh, boy. Dee, thanks a lot. And by the way, Dee mentioned it was a German dessert. And here's another thing I learned. I picked up quite a few things about newspapers back in the day. And there were a heck of a lot of newspapers, and I'll just zero in on the German ones, because in Wisconsin, you say there were over 200 newspapers published in German in Wisconsin. Is that really true, Jane?
It is true, and I'll actually hand this over to Randy. She is really an expert on these German newspapers.
Yeah, go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, there were lots of even small town newspapers. So where we know there was a large German population in Milwaukee, but then even smaller towns. I think it was Sauk City, that for a long time the only newspaper published there was in the German language, just because the people who settled there spoke German, printed German, and they started their own newspaper. So we have a lot of German language newspapers that we can now look at and kind of see. And we looked at some recipes that were in there. I think one of Jane's favorites, the Swimming Island, is another dessert that is not, I mean, that's also something we learned. It's definitely the recipes printed in immigrant newspapers are not representative of that cuisine, right? This was not the staple German recipes that immigrants brought necessarily, but maybe with a twist, maybe trying something new with ingredients they could find here. And so the Swimming Island, for example, is a dessert that is a hard-boiled egg that you roll in cinnamon and sugar, and then dunk in pancake batter, deep fry, and then cinnamon and sugar, more batter, deep fry, until all the batter is gone. And then you douse it in hot, sweetened wine.
Oh, boy. That's one I overlooked when I was reading your book. How did it taste?
It's amazing. I think I was a little bit apprehensive to try it. I couldn't really imagine, you know, cinnamon and sugar going with a hard-boiled egg, but it worked. It was great. I mean, it really just tasted like any other sort of fried food with that cinnamon taste in the dough, and it worked great with the egg, and then the hot, spiced, sweetened wine over it was, yeah, I loved it. It was incredible.
I guess Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, their book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. Great talking with them. And maybe you've got an experience to share or a story to tell. Hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Can't talk about food in Wisconsin without talking about cheese. How did Wisconsin become known for its cheese production? It really started as something farmers made for their own families, isn't it?
It did, yeah. That was something new to me that I learned when we were researching this book, is that cheese making was originally something just done on a small scale on a farm to preserve their dairy product, because it lasted a lot longer than dairy in other forms. And then a lot of our history of commercial cheese making dealt with people coming from New York State, and they brought with them their experience working in these cheese making factories, which standardized cheese making and kind of transformed the industry in Wisconsin to what it is today.
Yeah. In 1922, I think it was, the Wausau Pilot published a recipe for cheese and English walnut sandwiches. How do you make that sandwich? Jane, do you want to take that?
Of course, yeah. This sandwich, it's great. So you create the filling out of cheese mixed with walnuts, and I think we have some mayonnaise mixed in there too to kind of make it creamier. It's a very simple sandwich. And then you'll spread it on a slice of bread, add a leaf of lettuce, and another slice on top. And it was wonderful, though. I think I want walnuts in more sandwiches. It adds a great flavor and an amazing crunch to each bite.
I like the pimento sandwich recipe with cheese and, of course, pimentos and hard-boiled eggs. I thought, oh, I'm going to give that one a try. You deal a bit with the evolution of sandwiches. And I just saw an article in, I think it was Washington Post, about the popularity of sandwiches in our country. And, you know, how it's kind of the most popular thing that we eat anymore is, you know, a sandwich. But talk about the evolution of that. Randy, maybe?
I think it's kind of interesting to look at different sandwiches throughout time, right? We also have, like, the open-faced sandwich. And then if you wanted to take it on the road, right, you would close it up. And that's why we started looking at different recipes for the sandwiches, but also the different breads that would have been used. We have a recipe for a pumpernickel bread in there. I really like the ham sandwich, and it's almost like a ham, like salad sandwich. Mm-hmm. You got some pickles in there, some mustard, some softened butter. And then, yeah, you spread it on, we use the pumpernickel bread, and kind of serve it as an open-faced sandwich. And that's I think, my favorite sandwich in the book.
Oh, well, I'll have to give that one a try. And speaking of bread, you have kind of an interesting story about sourdough and how that term sourdough came about, Jane.
Yeah, sourdough, this really surprised us as we were searching through the newspapers trying to find some other sourdough recipes and just see what the mentions of sourdough were like. And we kept seeing sourdough being used as a reference for people. And we found that people going out to Alaska in the early days of the gold rush were being called sourdoughs because they would keep their sourdough starter in a little pouch close to their chest to keep it warm and alive. And it was a very popular thing with the folks out there, and it kind of turned into this term of being called a sourdough if you were going out for the gold rush.
Yeah, I thought that was it's just one of the many fascinating little side stories that just pepper the book, which makes it adds to the fun of reading it and looking at the recipes themselves. Lynn and Winnicani has something. Let's go there. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Good. Okay, just a little offering from the writer's point of view, a newspaper writer, a freelance writer. I was also a corporate and whatever staff writer, too, but it started in Hawaii. I moved to Hawaii from Winnicani here, and I had a column called The Nitty Gritty Grub Guide. This was in the 70s, kind of the, you know, almost edge of the hippie era or whatever. So I wrote, and it was just kind of fun. You know, I'd interview people, talk to people, had friends that made good whatever, and, of course, used, you know, Hawaiian recipes and things like that, Portuguese bean soup and stuff. And then I went into a corporate, well, a regular newspaper dining out section, and that related to restaurants, and that coupled up with also recipes sometimes. And then I came back to Wisconsin, and I got going with the Oshkosh Northwestern, and they kind of put together a package for me as a freelancer, kind of semi-staff freelancer, but again, the variety of people that I met, and I, you know, I do recipes, sturgeon and walleye or venison or apples, you know, the seasonal thing. So it was just a fun connection with getting back home again, too.
Oh, Lynn, thanks so much for calling. And it's great to hear from somebody who actually wrote recipes partially for a living. Jane, did you guys run into talk to any of the writers?
No, we didn't actually. We did work pretty hard to learn about a certain woman's editor. She would feature recipes sourced from local people in Wisconsin, which we just loved seeing because a lot of content in the newspapers for recipes was syndicated and wasn't coming locally from the state. But there was a column run by just the women's editor. They didn't name her. And we worked pretty hard to track down who she was We didn't have any luck, and we're still searching. But, yeah, we haven't spoken to any of the other writers.
Well, maybe somebody else has an idea and can call in and let you know that it's possible. Yeah. It's happened before on this program.
It was a Wausau pilot. So anybody who knows anything about the Wausau pilot women's editor, please let us know.
All right. The Wausau pilot women's editor. There you go. Lynn, thanks again. Barb in Madison, your turn. Hi, Barb.
A few years ago, my family is Czech, and my grandparents came over at the early part of the century, and so they brought all of their recipes. And a few years ago, we set about putting together a family cookbook and dug out all the handwritten stuff. And some of the things that we found were, like, for a casserole, use 15 cents worth of hamburger. And the Czechs had a lot of baked goods, you know, like raised breads, raisin breads, and sweet doughs and things like that. And so a lot of the recipes started out with make a sweet dough, not too sweet and not too heavy, you know. And when we would ask, like, my mom and my aunts and stuff like that, they kind of didn't really know either as far as quantities, you know, and they'd say, well, you know, flour and milk and eggs. And you go, well, what else? Like, is there yeast? And then they'd get kind of cranky, you know, they, of course there's yeast, you know, and enough, you know, add until it feels good and bake until done. And, you know, so it was kind of a challenge. And when we put the cookbook together, we really tried to not change the recipes at all. So it's kind of an adventure making them, you know.
Oh, Barb, that's wonderful. Well, you two, Randy, I'll turn to you maybe. You saw sort of similar kinds of things in some of the older recipes, didn't you?
Yes, definitely. What a great project to do that for the family history, too, right? Just to get a taste of what your ancestors ate as well. We ran into things where it was either, market price, right, 15 cents worth of whatever, which then the newspapers are a great resource because you can go in and you see how much things cost. Right down to that week, you could see what grocers would charge. So that may also help. We've also had some, I think it was like an egg white frosting. It just said to make a frosting. And we didn't really know what that would have entailed at the time. So really looking at the newspapers from that time and then finding just a basic recipe for that frosting and then going with that helped us a lot.
Oh, very, very cool. Barb, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, our guests today. Their book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. We're taking a look at the book, Extra, Extra, Eat All About It, with its authors, Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden. You can join in. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Stella in Sturgeon Bay has a comment for us. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Quite a number of years ago, my husband and I received a copy of my great-grandmother's church cookbook. That's from probably about mid-1800s. And we baked a recipe for ginger snaps. And at the end of the recipe, there was a comment from the woman who submitted it that said, "These will keep very well if locked up."
There you go. Stella, thanks for calling. Did you find a little bit of humor in any of those recipes, Jane?
Oh, let me think if we found any kind of humorous recipes, if you can think of any too, Randy.
I put together a wild game cooking cookbook once, and I, as a joke, I put in a recipe for elephant stew, which involved a medium-sized elephant, and I forget how many thousand gallons of water, and if more was needed, you could add one rabbit, but be careful because most people don't like a hare in their soup.
That's right. Yeah.
H-A-R-E. So anyway, enough about me. Can you remember? I suppose newspaper columnists probably wouldn't have, tried to make light of any of it.
I think we can maybe, with the, right, there were some tips on, etiquette tips on how to eat candy and how to share candy and sweets with others. Right, so that there's a little bit of the, you should share, but if you're offered, only take one or two, but don't take three. So there's a little bit of humor in that, yeah. But I think there are what we've seen is that people would kind of take the clippings from the recipe clippings from the newspaper and then kind of make their own scrapbook. Cookbook, and that's, I think, probably where in the margins they would have their own little comments.
Mm. Chuck in McHenry, Illinois, emailed in. He was leafing through an old cookbook and ran across a mention of pearl ash, an ingredient with which he was unfamiliar. At best, Chuck can determine the word is pronounced pearl ash and is made from wood ash lye.
Yeah, I think that's what they used for pretzel making, right? The pretzels.
Oh.
And in baking, yeah, because that's where you would need the lye to. Just lots of ingredients that we also had to kind of dig into first before we could really determine what it was.
Chuck wanted to know how you could make it yourself as it's no longer available. I'm not sure if we can answer that question, Jane.
I'm not sure we can either.
Maybe just make a fire and collect some ashes.
Pour some lye on it.
Don't sue us if you get sick.
Definitely look through the newspapers, though. You never know what you're going to find in there.
Really?
You might find some instructions.
Yeah. Yeah, an interesting story about cherries and prohibition and also how cherries came to be known from Door County.
Yeah, I've really loved researching cherries in Door County, and what I found so interesting was that they grew so well in that climate. It was a really good climate for them. The soil was amazing, but the issue is that a lot of the bedrock in Door County is really right below the soil, which naturally would make it really hard to plant trees. And we found some mentions of farmers resorting to dynamite to break up that bedrock to get their cherry trees in, which I just loved to imagine them doing that. Just amazing.
It would have been fun to watch that from a distance.
Yes, from a distance, definitely.
Well, what about the prohibition part of it with cherries?
Prohibition with cherries.
Or prohibition. Where there was some alcohol connections.
Oh, the maraschino cherries.
Yes.
Yeah. Because originally maraschino cherries came from Europe, and they were in an alcoholic liqueur, and so Americans had to come up with a different way of having that sweet treat on their sundae or in their then mocktails when Prohibition came around, and that's how the maraschino cherry that we now know was developed.
Yeah, really interesting. And I thought it was kind of interesting that vegetarianism is not a modern concept. And going back to Robert La Follette, I think, our former governor was a vegetarian.
He was, yes. And, it was amazing to see that vegetarianism has been around
for a long time, and kind of the early response to it was similar to how people kind of responded to vegans, I think. There was just, it was very strange, very otherworldly, and there were vegetarian restaurants in big cities, you know, like New York and coastal cities. So it just seemed like something folks do out in the cities. But it began to become more mainstream when Americans started to become more health conscious and interested in nutrition in the early 1900s. And then with the meatpacking scandals, there were a lot of issues with sanitation in meat, and that kind of pushed Americans even further to really embrace vegetarianism. But something that we found really humorous is that in a lot of recipes that were called vegetarian, there would be poultry, because oftentimes it was not considered to be meat. So, yeah, we just loved coming across that.
Yeah, I was thinking back. I was trying to remember the book, very popular book. Was it The Jungle by Upton Sinclair?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can remember reading that in my college days, and that it would be pretty much enough to turn anybody off from eating meat if you read that book.
Oh, yeah. It had a huge impact.
I know it did. Well, instant hot chocolate was invented right here in Wisconsin, and you tell that story and of course, have a recipe relating to it.
Yes, we talk a little bit about Swiss Miss, and that also just inventions that come out of things that are happening in the world. So it was a Wisconsin company that was making kind of powdered milk product for the troops during, I believe it was the Korean War. And they had to make, in order to fulfill their government contract, they overproduced. And then they had to figure out a way of using the extra they had. And so in the family kitchen, they started experimenting and turned that into the instant hot chocolate we still know today. And it was really fun to learn about that, that's part of Wisconsin history.
And in our last minute, there's one that the stuffed onions, the paper in a paper bag recipe, it's in the book, and it's one of your favorites, if I'm not mistaken.
Definitely. Yeah. We make that all the time.
And you've got some really interesting stories about paper bag cooking, because it was quite popular at one point, and people still do it a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I think it's mostly known now for kind of the French en papillote, so in enveloped and paper method, but the trend in the 19th actually came from a British chef that was then he came out with a cookbook, and a lot of people in the U.S. started cooking like that, and there were columns just dedicated to cooking anything in a paper bag in some of the Wisconsin newspapers.
Well, based on your recommendation and writing about it in the book, I'm definitely going to try this stuff. Onions cooked in a paper bag. I'm going to try that recipe. Jane Randy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. You've got a great book there, and I really enjoyed reading it. And I will follow up on the pimento sandwich and the stuffed onion in a paper bag for sure. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jane Conway and Randy Julia Ramsden, authors of Extra, Extra, Eat All About It. Fun talking with them, and I hope you get a chance to pick up a copy of the book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Johnny and the Raindrops, a song, I Like Chocolate. That's the song to get us going today on this hour of our program as we visit with Rowan Jacobson, an award-winning journalist who writes about science and nature for publications like the New York Times, Scientific American, and Outside. He is the author of 8 books, and his latest is a dandy. It's titled Wild Chocolate, Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. It's out just this month from Bloomsbury Publishing, and I finished reading it a couple of days ago and really enjoyed it. And as I talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Talk with him, too. What makes some chocolate better another chocolate, perhaps? Is chocolate like fine wine or a good cigar? Do you have to be an expert to know the difference? Join in the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Rowan Jacobson, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Larry. Great to be here.
Your new book, which is really a dandy, it's about fine chocolate that's come to prominence in the late 1990s, early 2000s. It's about the people who make it possible. And so there's a fine chocolate focus. But also, we get a look at history. We get a look at some adventures by the people who were really responsible for bringing this fine chocolate to the forefront. It reminds me at times of an Indiana Jones kind of saga. I mean, it's filled with just fascinating information about chocolate. And so I can see why you'd be interested, but what set you off on this journey to find the source of wild cacao?
Yeah, well, like you were saying, Larry, it was when the chocolate bars started getting a lot better in like the 1990s, 2000s, and you know, I'm a longtime food writer, so yeah. I wanted to know why were they better, like what was making them better, and so my initial interest was in following that back to the beginning, you know, but then as you like. It got complicated. The Indiana Jones stuff started to pop up unexpectedly, you know.
Oh, it makes it really a lot of fun to read. Chocolate, I have never asked a person, "Do you like chocolate?" and have them say, "Well, no, I hate chocolate." Everybody seems to love chocolate. A lot of it, though, that's consumed today. It's mass processed and comes from perhaps what you might call inferior cacao beans.
Yeah, inferior beans, and also grown. You know, the industry you know, engages in practices that aren't that ethical sometimes, and when how they're sourcing those beans and how they're treating the people who are growing them. So that was one of the big interests to me, is this new chocolate and new ways of producing it solves a lot of those problems and actually can be really beneficial for the people and the environment.
You know, when I grew up, the only way I've ever heard it pronounced was cocoa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You actually addressed the pronunciation of cacao and cocoa and chocolate.
Yeah, totally. Because it's everyone's confused by it, and it's just it's more complicated than it needs to be. Like the real short version is like the ancient Maya. They pretty much created chocolate, the culture of making it, and they called it like cacao or cacaoa. And so then that became cacao, and then the Spanish sort of called it cacao. But then once the British got involved, you know, they wanted to say it in a way that sounded more comfortable for English, so they changed it to cocoa. So it's now cocoa in, like, you know, the big industry calls it cocoa and cocoa beans. And back in the Americas where it started, they still call it cacao. And then the word chocolate comes from, it was the Maya word that meant cacao water, because they always had it as a drink rather than as a solid thing. So cacao meant cacao water, but then we turned it into chocolate.
Yeah, and that's been going on for 4,000 years, and it was primarily consumed as a drink?
Yeah, and still is in a lot of Latin America. But yeah, the Maya were definitely drinking it and using it for ceremonies 4,000 years ago. And some people in Ecuador were using it more like 5,000 years ago, and we don't know what they were doing with it, but we've found traces in pottery and stuff like that.
And chocolate itself is, you write about this, is very chemically complex.
The number
of flavor, aroma and flavor compounds is, I don't remember now, over 700, I think I remember.
Yeah, it is. It's hundreds and hundreds, and it's just like a really complex substance. And you know it when you taste it, right? It's got the rich, you know, buttery elements, and it's got bitter elements, and it can taste almost like nutty and toasty. It's just an incredibly complicated food, and the the pharmacological compounds are complicated too. It gives you a good little rush, you know.
It does indeed. Well, as we said, the 90s, late 1990s, early 2000s, the European chocolate makers were sourcing cacao beans from all over the world. And maybe you could explain the importance of terroir.
I mean,
it's something we normally think about relating to wine, as you point out in the book, but talk about the importance of terroir.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a word that comes from the wine industry, and usually it's a French word, gets translated as the taste of place. And it's in wine, they talk about terroir to explain why, you know, a Chardonnay grape in one spot in, say, Burgundy will produce a very different tasting wine than a Chardonnay grape in California, right? It's the terroir. It's the way the environment changes the flavor of the thing. Same thing is true in chocolate. And it's partly has to do with the environment, but also partly with the genetics, the strain of cacao that you use. And basically, you mentioned earlier that a lot of the chocolate that we eat, especially if it's, you know, what's in the candy aisle at the grocery store, is produced from beans that aren't very good. Those cocoa beans were chosen because they produce a lot. The trees produce a ton of beans rather than because they have a great flavor. So the ones with great flavor are kind of back in the Americas where cacao originated, and they don't produce nearly as much yield, but they have all those great flavor compounds that we like.
Yeah, and a lot of the sort of mass-produced comes from Africa, does it not?
Yeah, so even though it's native to the Americas, when chocolate became like a big worldwide product in the 1700s and 1800s, they started planting it in Africa because it was cheaper to produce it there. The labor was cheaper, the farms were cheaper. And still today, about 70% of all the world's chocolate comes from Western Africa.
But the good stuff comes from Central and South America.
Yeah. So the stuff that for thousands of years people were using because it tasted so great kind of got left behind when the industry became, a big commodity. And only recently, when people started really caring a lot about the flavor in chocolate, did they get rediscovered. So they're still kind of hanging out in the jungle, these old varieties that taste really unusual and delicious. So that's where the Indiana Jones part comes in, because you have to go find them. And then people are trying to do that now.
Yeah. And there at one point, as you know, there was an idea that there was no more wild chocolate anywhere.
That's how this started for me. Is I found out about this bar that claimed to be made with wild cacao from the Amazon in Bolivia, and people were skeptical. Everyone thought that the wild stuff had disappeared a long time ago. But this one German guy who was sourcing these beans in Bolivia, he was on these online forums saying, no, it's wild. Really, it is. Like, no one believes me. So I got in touch with him and said, like, is it really wild? He said, yeah, come check it out. I have to go get some more. I have to do this expedition. You can come. So I, not thinking about it too hard, said, sure.
Victor Lehman is his name. And he was an interesting guy. I could tell the little background on him. He was a forester or some training in forestry, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. He likes to grow things, trees and other tropical crops. He's German, but he'd lived in the Amazon for a long time doing development work, basically trying to figure out ways that the people there could make a living off the standing forest so they wouldn't cut it down for cattle ranches, which is the big problem the Amazon faces. So he was always looking at what crops could grow in the forest, in the shade of the forest, and actually produce something. And he discovered this wild cacao there that loves to be in the shade of the forest. That's where it naturally grows. And no one had ever thought it tasted good because it hadn't been treated well. Like it was often rotted in while people were trying to dry it. So he improved the sort of harvesting production of it, and it turned out it was incredibly delicious. So this is that bar that made a big splash in the early 2000s, and I tasted.
Yeah, and I'd like to taste. I haven't had that chance yet. But maybe at this point, it would be worth it to talk about what happens to that bean and what needs to happen and what he discovered. And, you know, he did some trial and error as well.
Years of trial and error, yeah. And this is the nerdy part.
Yeah, like, but it's really interesting to me.
Yeah, as I was working on the book, I was like, I can't believe I'm going to write half a book about fermentation. But that's the gist of it is, to make beautiful chocolate, you have to take those beans through a pretty complicated process, this like chemical process. So the beans grow in these pods on these little trees called cacao trees. And you open up the pod, it looks almost like a squash. And inside are the beans covered in this sweet pulp. And so if you just took those beans and dried them and ground them into chocolate, they wouldn't taste very good at all. They would just kind of taste astringent and bitter. So what you have to do is let that pulp that's there ferment on the beans. So it's almost like making wine or something where you put them all in a box or a vat and let all the pulp ferment into alcohol. And then that alcohol turns into acids, acetic acids, which is the natural, it happens with, you know, with wine and vinegar the same way. But as that's happening, all those alcohols and acids actually soak into the beans and break apart the cells in the beans and trigger this molecular chain reaction, which produces the chocolate flavors. And we have no idea who figured that out first or how long it took them. It obviously probably happened over hundreds or thousands of years. But that you have to do all that, and then you have to dry the beans, and you have to do all that in a very humid rainforest without letting it rot. So you can't let the fermentation go too far, but you have to let it go far enough. So it's this really controlled process that you have to get right if you want to have the best chocolate.
Yeah, it's an amazing process, and of course you go into it a little more. And you do it in a very entertaining way. You describe this whole process through the eyes of people who are actually doing it and teaching others how to do it, which I found really fascinating. Shanna in Stevens Point has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Shanna.
Hi, it's Shana, actually, but that's okay. my daughter, sometimes she'll eat different kinds of chocolate bars, and some of them, she says, burns the back of her throat, while some of them don't. So I'm just wondering if that's like a quality thing or if it's a certain ingredient that maybe it's an allergy or what could be up with that.
Yeah.
My guess would be that it's the astringency. Like chocolate naturally has this astringency in it. How old is she?
She's 15.
Oh, okay. She's pretty old. Yeah, I think it's just like, yeah, there's this natural, like almost like if you have oversteeped tea or oversteeped coffee, there's this, astringency in chocolate that's natural. If you're getting the more expensive chocolate and the one that has a higher cocoa content to it, then that's probably going to be more pronounced. That'd be my guess.
Yeah, that could well be the case. Shana, thank you very much for calling. A listener emailed to ask, what are the health benefits of dark chocolate versus milk chocolate? Which brand makes the best dark chocolate?
So all chocolate is good for you. It's got a lot of different antioxidants in it. So the same reason that's good to eat nuts and fruits and vegetables, chocolate's like a very concentrated form of that. But dark chocolate, you know, milk chocolate is the same as dark chocolate, except it's diluted with milk, with powdered milk. So you're going to have less chocolate in there and more milk. And often milk chocolate has more sugar as well, not always. So dark chocolate is just going to be more concentrated. And you can, most of the good chocolates now, they list their cacao content right on the label. So you like milk chocolate might be 30% or 40% chocolate, cocoa. And dark chocolate's going to be, you know, 65 to 85% cocoa. So it's just going to have a lot more of the stuff in there.
Yeah. And we've got other callers coming in. But just a reminder, we're visiting today with Rowan Jacobson. He has a dandy new book out. It's titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Rowan Jacobson about his book titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. Great to have him with us today. And several questions and emails coming in. David Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So can a person go out and find these wild seeds, bring them home, and grow as many as they want without domesticating them, kind of like an heirloom seed? The heirloom seed stays the same variety and everything. Would that work? And also, when you make the chocolate, is the process the same with all chocolate, or is it different with wild beans?
Hey, really good questions. Let me take that second one first. Yeah, all chocolate is made in kind of the same way. Once you've dried those beans, you just grind them up and add sugar. And you know, if you've ever been to Mexico, you'll see these little patties of chocolate for sale in the markets that are ground like just by hand or in very basic machines. So they'll be really grainy, but like the really smooth chocolate that we tend to like, it's just the machines can grind it really, really fine, but it's just chocolate and sugar and, you know, whatever. Sometimes they'll add other ingredients like vanilla, but that's it. Just grind. It's almost like making peanut butter in a sense. And in terms of growing them, yeah, you can take the seeds from a pod and plant them and new trees will pop up and pretty fast because it's the tropics. In just a few years, they'll start to produce their own pods. Of course, you have to be in the tropics. It's not going to work in Wisconsin. but cocoa trees, they like it really warm and moist. They can only grow about 20 degrees on either side of the equator.
And Victor Lehman, who we were talking about earlier, just a really such an interesting character anyway, who just got, I don't know, deeply in love with the wild trees that he found, cacao trees, and he bought, I think, 13,000 acres for $10,000.
Yeah,
his whole savings.
Right, only in Bolivia can you get away with that, you know.
And grew. He was looking for the wild, but he was able to take some wild and grow them up as trees.
Right, these old varieties that have been out there forever, literally, you know, millions of years probably. You can plant them just like the caller was asking, and get your own cacao forest.
Nina and Menasha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Good morning. I'm so excited that you have this guest on, because I'm a foodie, my family here are foodies, and we've taken trips to Oaxaca, Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I witnessed a wonderful, the mole and the Dia de los Muertos, which is Day of the Dead, November 2nd of every year. I was there for the celebrations, and they have like little booths where the indigenous people would bring baskets of their family recipes, and then they hand them, they purchase by the kilo, these toasted and roasted cacao beans, and then they mix it all together. They pour it all in, and it comes out like a paste. But I just wanted to tell people that if they can get a hold of Mayo Dormo, it's a brand chocolate from Oaxaca, Mexico. It's the best I've ever had, and I've had a lot of chocolate.
Well, what do you think, Rowan?
Oh, yeah. Well, you nailed it. Oaxaca is one of the world's great chocolate hotspots. Part of my book is set there. And, like every family has their own recipe for making these mole sauces, which usually have cacao as one of the ingredients in them. Mm-hmm. You can also buy chocolate drinks for sale on the street corners. Little old ladies like ladling out their own special recipe for a chocolate drink. And Mayor Domo is this bigger company that has a few spots in Oaxaca City. And they've got these great old machines that must date from the early 1900s that they use to grind the chocolate on premises. And they make all these drinks and hard chocolates. So yeah, Oaxaca is a super concentrated collection of heirloom cacaos and cacao recipes. And if you go out into the countryside, you can actually find some growing still.
Yeah. Thank you, Nina, for calling. And Amy in Door County, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Gosh, I hate to have to be the one to bring it up. I was hoping somebody else would, especially right next to all those lovely, charming village-type stories, which I'm sure are a totally different scenario. But don't we have to talk about, is it true about there being child slavery involved in the production of chocolate?
Amy, thanks. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, that's really important to talk about. And it's another thing I talk about in the book. This is a problem that's been argued about for decades. And the gist of it is that, like I mentioned, most of the cacao in the world is being grown in Africa by farmers who are very poor. It's crazy. They make about 78 cents a day for producing cacao. And, you know, and that's for their whole family, right? So the prices for cacao have always been so low that the farmers have very little money. And so then what they end up doing is their children work for free. And because this part of Africa also has a lot of unrest, civil wars, and countries that are basically falling apart. So there's also a lot of refugees. And some refugees turn up on these cacao farms and you end up working for free in exchange for a place to live. So it's just really, rough conditions. But it all comes down to the incredibly low prices that the industry pays for cocoa. So these farmers can't really make a go of it. And they end up getting their kids to work for free. So for 20 years ago, the U.S. government actually threatened to slap labels on chocolate products, like certifying that they either were or weren't made with child labor. And of course, the industry freaked out and hired Bob Dole and I forget a couple other like very prominent ex-senators to lobby hard to make sure that didn't happen. But in response, as a deal, they agreed to get child labor out of the chocolate trade by 5 years. And that was in 2001. They didn't make it. So in 2005, they said, all right, we're trying. Let's push it to 2010. 2010, they couldn't do it either. They said, how about 2020? 2020, they kind of admitted that they couldn't even trace where most of their cocoa beans were coming from. So they're still working on it. They have made some progress, but still a huge problem. And it goes back to price. Like cocoa is a commodity, like oil or soybeans or whatever else. So the prices go up and down, but it's bought by traders who are driving a very, very hard bargain. And there's so many different middlemen from those fields in Africa to the coast, to ships that ship it to Europe and the US, to the people who actually grind the cacao and then sell it to, you know, the big players like Hershey's. So with that many middlemen, that's why so little money makes it back to the farmers. So what has to happen is more money needs to make it to those, into the hands of those farmers, and the industry needs to step up to make sure that no kids are getting pulled in anymore.
And when it comes to the fine chocolates, there are some women who have played an important role in helping, at least in Central America and South America, to get more money to those farmers, at the same time making some money themselves. And the one woman I really wanted you to talk about was Emily Stone. And maybe just give the background. You're giving some of the background because in I think it was Hershey that pulled out of the this area and left farmers high and dry who were trying to do organic chocolate. Well, you tell that story.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the solutions to this whole problem is to cut out all those middlemen and just establish relationships that are more direct, where the chocolate makers are buying the beans directly from the farmers. So a lot more money can go to the farmers. And so there's more of a relationship rather than just like this commodity game. So because that ends up being a lot easier in Latin America for various reasons. So this new wave of chocolate makers who want to make their own chocolate straight from the beans, they've all gone to Latin America to try to establish relationships with the farmers. And so Emily Stone was this woman who in like 2010, I believe, she was an activist. She'd worked with Greenpeace. She was part of a campaign to try to get Hershey's to get child labor out of their supply chain. But then she decided she wanted to be participate more directly. So she went to Belize in 2010 and just started meeting with the cocoa farmers down there and saying to them, you know, like, can I just buy beans directly from you? You can skip this whole commodity process, because they were still selling. They were selling for a very low price at the time. So she set up these fermentation and drying facilities so that they could improve the quality of their cocoa so they could get a higher price. And then she set up arrangements with chocolate makers in the U.S. so that the beans would be shipped directly to the chocolate makers. And the chocolate makers agreed to pay higher prices, partly because the quality was good and partly because they wanted to help out the farmers. And so then she developed this company called Uncommon Cacao that has become sort of the main middleman for fine chocolate, that finds these really great beans in the Americas and sells them directly to these small, what are called bean to bar chocolate makers in the US. And this has really changed the game. So a lot more money for the farmers, a lot better quality chocolate. So everybody's happier on both ends. And that's a lot of my book focuses on this sort of completely separate system for producing and supplying chocolate.
And she had to do a bit of educating on her own, if I'm not mistaken, of educating farmers on, you know, how to prepare and have those beans properly processed and so forth and dried.
Yeah, and that was the key. Like they kind of knew how to make it good, but one of the things that's hard for us, I think, in the U.S. to wrap our heads around is like how little these farmers have to work with. Like none of them have vehicles usually. It's really, you know, like developing world conditions. So their houses are pretty simple. They get around on foot or by bus. So, you know, say you're a farmer, you've got all these cocoa beans. Even if you manage to, you know, successfully ferment and dry them with your very limited infrastructure, what happens then? In Belize, there used to be, there was one buying station. So all the farmers had to carry, you know, hundreds of kilos of beans that they had just dried onto a bus with them. and travel to the buying station and hope the buying station was open, because it was only open like once or twice a week, and hope that they were buying that day and would buy the beans. Otherwise, they would have to haul them all back on the bus. So insane system. And like, you can see why it basically wasn't working. So what Emily Stone did at the age of 25 when she arrived was to create this whole new, this centralized facility called Maya Mountain Cacao that would guarantee to buy all of the beans from these farmers, and in fact would send a truck around to pick them up. So it's like a simple solution like that makes all the difference to these farmers in some of these very poor places. So the quality was good. The farmers, it was much easier for the farmers. So then more and more people started farming cacao in the area, and Belize has now become like a leader in fine chocolate.
Yeah, it has indeed. And she had her own troubles. You know, we haven't talked at all about coyotes, what they called coyotes, who were kind of mad about the fact that she was buying up, these were guys who were going around and just picking up the pods or the beans and giving nothing or very little for that. And here she was coming in and promising higher money, more money.
Yeah, one of the things that really surprised me was how often the chocolate trade intersects with crime, with organized crime in these places that tend to be fairly lawless places, whether it's a drug trade or just like, you know, everyday crime. But yeah, so these farmers who had no way to sell their beans and had no vehicles before someone like Maya Mountain was sending a truck around, their coyotes are these, people in Latin America who do have maybe a vehicle and will just go town to town buying whatever farmers are producing for incredibly low amounts of money, because they know they're the only game in town. So they'll be like, oh, you got some corn, you got some cacao, you know, I'll give you a buck for it. And often farmers were just forced to take it. So Emily and Maya Mountain Cacao basically started shouldering those coyotes out of the game by offering much higher prices and more convenience, first in Belize and then in Guatemala. And now Uncommon Cacao operates in a number of different countries. But not surprisingly, the coyotes were not thrilled to be losing. So there's been guns, there's been threats, there's been machetes. That's just constantly part of the like sort of like simmering background of chocolate production, you know?
Yeah. Rana in Lake Halley has a question about some combinations of cacao and other things. Let's go there. Hi, Ron. Rana.
Hi, Larry. Hello to your guest. I've read your articles many times in Scientific American, and I'm very excited to listen to your talk today. Two questions is, what would you recommend for a good cacao and dried pepper combination to drink? You know, a dried pepper with capsaicin, not black pepper, that wouldn't light my mouth on fire. And then the second one is, from the Jack Nicholson movie, Cocopelli. Is that actually real? I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you so much.
I don't know that Jack Nicholson movie, so you'll have to fill me in on that one.
I don't either. But what about the other part of the question?
Oh, so all right. So for chocolate, I would send anyone who wants to like sort of check out some of these really great chocolates. There's a website called Caputo's, and Caputo's is the primary importer of fine chocolate in the U.S. And so they have all the good stuff on their site. And then I believe the chocolate ships for free. That selection, you can't go wrong. Just look for any of the drinking chocolates or the sipping chocolates, because those will come in small bits that are really easy to dissolve in hot water. And some of them do have spice in them. There's a shop in New Hampshire called Dancing Lion Chocolate. This guy he was a nuclear physicist who became a chocolate maker. And he takes his chocolate craft about as seriously as he took nuclear physics. So he does some amazing products, and he sells an incredible drinking chocolate. He's got two of them. One is spicy and one is not spicy. So you could go for either one.
I have the fortune in Madison. We have some chocolatiers, some very good ones, and I have the advantage of living a 5-minute or a little less than 5-minute walk from Gail Ambrosius, chocolatier.
Oh yeah.
Who was named one of the 10 best chocolatiers in North America.
Yeah, no, you're sitting pretty there.
And she always has some chocolate, liquid chocolate that you can just taste when you come in the store or in her shop. And she is one of the people who I think probably has benefited a lot from the work that was done by the gal that we were talking about earlier, whose name's Emily Stone, mm-hmm. because she works Gail, for example, works directly with farmers, has been there, actually lived on the farm, has spent time on the farms, and uses single source chocolate for a lot of hers.
Yeah, no, she's well known in the industry, and she's very representative of this new wave of chocolatiers who are really partnering with the farmers in a way that never used to happen in the old days.
Yeah, talking today with Rowan Jacobson, and we have some more callers online. We have some email questions, but you can join in, try to get on here. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. His book. Take a look at it. It's titled Wild Chocolate Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our guest today, Rowan Jacobson, his book titled Wild Chocolate. And let's take a call from Kathy in Harshaw, Wisconsin. Kathy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I don't know if you've discussed Fortunato chocolate or seen the book on Finding Fortunato. So the fellow says that they found a rare chocolate that they thought had gone extinct. It was the national white cacao bean. They found it in a remote canyon in Peru. And it was at small farmers. I guess it was a chocolate that was preferred by nobility in Europe when they were first invaded by the Europeans. And they thought it had gone extinct. But they found it in a small farm, and they said the secret of it was it was a mixture of many fruit trees and nut trees, and that the roots kind of intermingle, and they absorb some of the qualities of those trees. I didn't know if you'd already discussed this or not.
Well, we certainly have talked a bit about the wild trees and people thinking they were extinct, but what about this particular white bean?
Yeah, Fortunato is another one of the famous ones. It's one of the ones I mentioned in the book, and it's a great story where it was back in the 1700s. It was the pride of Ecuador, and all their chocolate was made with it. And it did have most cacao beans are purple, and that purple the bitterness compounds are in the purple. So since ancient times, people have looked for trees that produced whiter beans because they didn't have that bitterness in them. And back in the day, they didn't have any sugar, so they were drinking it unsweetened. So you really wanted to get that bitterness out if you could. So the white beans were really prized. And then, of course, as I was saying earlier, it became a big industry worldwide. They weren't so worried about flavor. So these beautiful white bean varieties got forgotten and left to the jungle. And everyone thought they were extinct, but they are being found more and more, and Peru and Ecuador are two of the hot spots that probably have more than anywhere else. That Fortunato was literally this, like, it really was like Indiana Jones, where it was this valley that was really hard to get to, and the trees had just been growing there for centuries, and then these guys that were working with a local mining operation found them and thought they were weird looking, and had heard that white beans were were prized and everyone was looking for them. So they brought them to the industry, brought them to some cocoa experts. And the experts were like, oh my God, where did you guys get this? And so now they're back, and you can find those on the Caputo site too.
Yeah, and Matt, you have a piece on Matt, stories relating to Matt Caputo in your book.
Yeah, so he's been an important player who is just really passionate about these about helping the farmers and bringing some of these really unusual tastes back into circulation so people can experience them.
Rick in Sturgeon Bay, what's on your mind?
Oh, hello, Larry, and thank you for taking my call. I worked for many years with the Miskito people in eastern Honduras in an area known as La Mosquitia. Two groups have just recently begun cacao operations, hoping to generate some income for them locally. They're both along the Patuca River, which apparently is a good site for growing cacao. But they're relatively inexperienced, as am I. And so I have two questions. One, where might we be able to contact someone who could give us some expertise about growing, cultivating cacao? And then the second one would be, where could we look for someone here in the States that might be interested in buying the cacao once it starts producing?
Hmm. Yeah, really great questions, and that's amazing. That's fascinating. Those are also good cacao operation, good cacao places. I would recommend reaching out to a group called the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund. This is a nonprofit that focuses on bringing back these old varieties, and they'd be a great first point of contact. You can find their website quite easily. It's hcpcacao.org, I think, and so they can help connect you with people who are interested. And they also, you can actually submit your beans for heirloom designation through them. And so then they work with a lot of chocolate makers to connect chocolate makers and chocolate growers. So that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah, and maybe talk a bit more about that foundation, because that's in and of itself an interesting story that you write about.
Yeah, and it actually started with that Fortunato, that cacao from Ecuador. That was when people started realizing, like, oh wow, there are amazing flavors of cacao to be found in the American tropics, but they're disappearing, right? Because nobody's been using these for sometimes two or three centuries. The trees will get cut down eventually, or the forests will get cleared. So suddenly, everyone realized time was tight, and somebody had to really be more actively going out there and finding these things. So it's kind of like Indiana Jones, only instead of golden idols, you're trying to find these like golden pods of cacao. So Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund was a partnership between the USDA and the Fine Chocolate Industry Association. And so what they do is they actually reach out to farmers who aren't getting recognition for their beans, but might have really unusual beans with unique genetics. And so the farmers submit a few kilos of beans, and then the beans are ground in, made into a chocolate by Guittard Chocolate Company in San Francisco, but blind, like nobody participating knows where the sample came from. They just make it into a chocolate with their standard recipe. And then there's a tasting panel that also blind tastes each submission, and the ones that get scored really high get designated as heirlooms. And then they do genetic testing to find out what the background of the beans is. And then they have a whole like ceremony, and they announce the new heirloom designees. And usually that generates a lot of interest from chocolate makers and working with those beans.
Yeah. The Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund, for our earlier caller, in case he missed the name of it, a place to go online and take a look, and you'll maybe get some help there. Rex in Madison has a question. Hi, Rex.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question. Every morning I do a shot of instant coffee and a double shot of cacao powder, like what we would call hot cacao, and I'm concerned about how much lead is in the cacao powder that we buy here.
That was a question Stan in Madison had also wondered about, lead and cadmium content of cacao in South America sources.
Yeah, that is definitely a question. Consumer Reports did a test like a year ago, I think, or maybe a little more, and found, like across the board, a lot of chocolate samples were high in cadmium and lead. So yeah, how much of a problem is that? And I've looked pretty carefully into it, and I think it's only a problem if you do a lot of chocolate. Like if you're doing Rex, I think you said you're doing you like a double dose of cocoa powder every morning. So that's probably a significant amount. The cadmium is just naturally found in soils in the tropics. So that's, you know, you're going to get some of that all over the place. Like we already get cadmium every day in our grains and vegetables that we eat. But if you're eating a lot of dark chocolate, you might be doubling the amount you're getting every day. Cadmium isn't associated with any huge health concerns, unless you're like, you know, your farm is next to the battery facility. And, yeah. And, but lead, like at any level, is a concern, and lead gets on, it doesn't get pulled into the trees, but lead is in the air, like air pollution, especially in the developing world around cities and roads. And it just settles on the beans when they're drying. So the best way to avoid lead in chocolate is to get chocolate that's coming from the rainforest, that's coming from a natural natural area. Probably going organic is a good way to go on that too.
Yeah. Rex, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, the book's just out. What kind of response are you getting?
So far, huge. It turns out, you know, surprise, surprise, people are really interested in chocolate.
Well, I can see why, especially if they read your book. You know, I'm thinking of taking a copy of your book over to Gail Ambrosius. And
Please do. Compliments.
I know Gail quite well, and I've talked with her many times, and I'm pretty sure that she would be interested in reading your book for sure. And several people are saying, what are the specific chocolate brands you recommend?
Again, go to Caputo's, and everything that's on there is you know, pre-approved for awesomeness, in all seriousness. The one, there's one that I write about quite a bit in the book that I should recommend. Louisa Abram is the woman who makes the chocolate, and she's in Brazil, and she works only with purely wild cacao, and she makes a different bar from seven different rivers in the Amazon in Brazil. So you get a completely different flavor from each, that's based on the cacao that's found on each river. And so like her story is a big part of the book, and I think many of her bars are available on the Caputo's website.
Well, this has been a lot of fun for me, and we did not even get into you landing in the in the jungle on an airstrip that was actually used by cocaine distributors, and that story. And you really bring to life what it's like for the farmers and what it's like for the people. And I learned so much. I was just so grateful that you wrote this book. Thank you so much, Rowan, for being with us today and for writing your book. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it very much. Rowan Jacobson, S-E-N, not S-O-N, like we often see here in Wisconsin, is the author, and his book titled Wild Chocolate, Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. Thanks to him, and thank you for listening. And, of course, always a big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud. Joel produced this specific show. Technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.